Welcome, folks. Another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. And my mind is sure expanded because I'm speaking to you from the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors Estate in near the Hudson River, a couple hours north of New York City. And it's really remarkable what Alex and Allison Gray have been able to manifest here, I think, in less than a decade. There's a number of buildings. There's a lot of incredible visionary art scattered around the beautiful grounds. Lots of Alex and Allison's paintings everywhere and other works of visionary art, a great store. It's just kind of an amazing place, and they hold monthly full moon ceremonies here and art church and workshops, and I'll be giving a talk this Saturday on reanimism up here. But it's just kind of incredible to be, you know, in at a place that's just essentially a kind of visible, on-the-map church in the loose sense of visionary culture, of a kind of psychedelic exuberance, and a real kind of like waving a flag. You know, it's not a, it's a reminder of how quickly these things are changing, and how visionary art and visionary culture is really actually only one aspect of the various ways in which psychedelic experience is changing in culture and in consciousness, in law, in medicine, and really in just the views of what it means to be human. And along those lines, I'm really happy this episode to speak with Lex Pelger, who's one of the folks I think of as the Young Turks or Turkettes, in the sense of a distinctly different generation than mine, that you're coming up with a fresh sensibility that in some ways owes less to the sort of high and holy hippie visionary tradition that Alex and Allison Gray represent, and perhaps a little bit more to Alexander Shulgin, and that if you could almost sort of identify different streams within psychoactive and psychedelic discourse of kind of who the heroes are, who the sort of the elders are, you know, and there's a Terence McKenna stream, there's still a Timothy Leary stream holding on strong, there's a Mountain Girl stream, and there's definitely a Shulgin stream, which has to do more with science, with research, with chemistry, with a certain kind of more empirical approach, but one that is still open to the hedonic and spiritual possibilities of these molecules. And Lex has been tracking this stuff as a writer, scientist, and a self-declared son of Shulgin. He's one of the hosts of Symposia, which is a psychoactive conference and a culture node, and currently putting out more and more material online. So he's written as a journalist, but in a way, what first really got me interested in his work and his perspective was this immense project that he's been involved in researching and writing for many years, and that we've just seen a little dollop of released a couple in June. And this project is an immense book called Anandamide or the Cannabinoid, and it is based in ways that we'll have to explore with Lex himself on Moby Dick, as well as a very thorough look at the history, culture, politics, and chemistry of the cannabinoid system, the endocannabinoid system within us, and the ways in which we can understand the hysterical reaction to this powerful and healing substance by looking at Ahab's violent pursuit of the whale of cannabinoid ecstasy. But we'll get to that in a little bit. Right now, I just want to say hi to Lex and welcome him to Expanding Mind. How's it going, man?
Good. Great. Thanks, Eric.
Great. You know, I want to start out, you studied science, like real deal science. You were doing the science. You have some publications. You were really interested in that. I'd love to hear a little bit about that. But more to the point, Why didn't just keep on the sort of conventional track of like, okay, now I go to grad school, now I get a postdoc, now I'm working in a lab, now I'm, you know, getting my name on more papers, blah, 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 blah. Somewhere along the way, you decided to go in a different direction, and I'd like to hear about that.
Yeah, it was always science that fascinated me. Ever since I learned about Punnett squares in genetics in seventh grade, I just thought this stuff is incredible. And so when I went to school, I studied biochemistry and really enjoyed it. And then went to a lab in Valhalla, New York. I was living in the city, but going up there, reverse commute every day, doing stem cell research. And it was great, and it was fascinating. I really enjoyed being in a wet lab, having all of these balls up in the air of different experiments running. And but after a year and a half, you know, we pretty much learned that one small protein at the bottom of a kidney bound to another one. And it was such slow, precise work. And it was a good sense of what it takes to do basic science. But I realized I probably wasn't going to be my angle. And so I saved up the money, and I went to India for a year with my kid sister, in fact. And that's what actually got me started on the writing path, because I'd always been a reader, but that's where I first had something that was really worth writing about, just life in the subcontinent.
Yeah, and you had a boisterous time over there, if I recall. In fact, I think it ended with you getting literally kicked out of the country.
Yeah, I mean, it was more a deportation of convenience. This whole Tibetan protest march that I followed for a couple months through North India, it had just become a political embarrassment to the Indians with their, you know, one of their big trading partners, China. And so they kept arresting the marchers, but the marchers kept just marching back towards China. And it was my first real sense of realpolitik. You know, these Tibetans were going to sacrifice themselves in the torture they'd already experienced at the hands of the Chinese, even though it would barely make a newspaper article in the West. You know, it made more of a difference when the three of us foreigners got arrested than when 100 monks and nuns got arrested. And it was my first sense of how dark the world can be.
Yeah, and then you were also writing about that, and you continued to write as you roved around the States. And I ask about the science partly because I'm really, you know, in a way, the path that you were pursuing, or at least were on for a little while, is kind of the one that we're most familiar with. You know, you do basic research, you go on, you get, you know, maybe you become famous, maybe you're just a cog in a laboratory, et cetera, et cetera. And that's really, what we think of as doing science. But in a lot of ways, what you're doing now is also kind of doing science. You're not doing basic research, but you're staying very much within the flows of scientific information. In your journalism and in your book, you're writing about this for people who maybe don't know as much about science. So you're part of tracking it, but not just as a journalist, as someone who is really invested in how scientific knowledge can transform culture and politics. And particularly in terms of the psychedelic renaissance and the kind of changing views of psychoactives. So when you call yourself a scientist now, what is it that you're tuning into? What's important about keeping that legacy part of what your practice is?
It's as I kept reading about science and studying the history of it, it started to become more clear that the pendulum of how science works, which is always swinging back and forth like any human endeavor, it's gotten to such a reductionist stage at this point that it can be really silly. And so much of the history of science wasn't done in the laboratory, it was done in the bar or at the library. So many great insights were people talking to each other and cross-fertilizing, getting breakthroughs, getting ideas, and this last century taking some acid and realizing that you can create the PCR technique to make more copies of DNA. And as powerful as this reductionist technique is, it's very blind in its way, or it's very small step in its way. And the more I'm on the road and talking to people about cannabis as a medicine, the more it's just painful that the phrase anecdotal data means lesser data, not quite real data. When really, if you're talking about a very rare disease only a couple hundred people on the planet have, then I think your best source of data is the old lady in California who said, I tried so many different pharmaceuticals for this, in fact, all of them, and it turns out the last thing I was willing to try was cannabis, and that's what worked. that's an essential piece of data, but it's not, there's no easy path for that kind of data to get out into the mainstream now. It's there aren't science journals for stories of patients and things like that. There are, and there are movements in that way, but the whole as I read Nature and stuff like that, the whole apparatus of science hasn't really been affected yet by this internet revolution in a lot of ways. Just like it's going to take a while for the government and the church to really integrate how changing the network is, just like the printing press was changing, science is slowly, creakily trying to incorporate the power that's going to happen from this increased networking.
Yeah, and it's so what you're talking about is that it's not just a matter of what we think of as journalism. It's something almost more like storytelling or story collecting on the one hand for all the cultural richness, but also as, you know, real data that can spread out there and inspire people and encourage people to try these medicines for themselves, depending on what ails them. And, you know, and what ails us and what cannabis can do for what ails us is I know one of your main the firebrands you wave in front of a still rather hostile America, even though things are obviously changing a great deal. There's still a sense that the real medical value of cannabis is, you know, maybe still a little bit obscured. I know that one of your raps has to do with weed for grandma, and that's kind of based on some of your own experiences with your own grandmother and the way in which that turned you on, you know, in somewhat a sad way in some regards to the possibility of these of the healing properties of cannabis.
Yeah, it's why I believe I'm going to be starting my book with hubris about how little I knew. I thought I was some hotshot young drug writer who knew a decent amount about each of the major drugs, and I stumbled upon some good sources in the cannabis world, and I realized I didn't know anything. I didn't know what anandamide was. I didn't even know who Jack Herer was at the time, and the more I started listening, the more I thought this information is so far out there, it's hard to believe. And I didn't really realize its medical benefits when I most would have wanted to, because I lost my grandmother to Parkinson's disease. And it turns out that is one of the most obvious and incredible uses of various types of cannabis preparations is for Parkinson's and the other neurodegenerative diseases. And I did get her to try just a drop or two before she passed, but that was only because I'd spent so much time trying. It took me so long to realize it would help. It took me then so much longer to convince her, and by then it was too late. And so it's the reason that I just preach this everywhere I go is, of all of the obvious benefits from legalizing cannabis, however that's going to look, is half of it is the dark side of stop putting people of color in prison for this plant. And the light side, the lowest hanging fruit of the good, is increased access for medical cannabis to our parents and to our grandparents. Because I know it sounds almost too crazy to be true, but I think cannabis is the closest thing to a panacea for all of the different diseases of aging as any medicine or plant that we've found so far.
Yeah, well, let's stay on that for a little bit, because I know you've talked about this, and when I hear that, I have a similar reaction that you've talked about having when you were earlier on and you were doing your studies, and as you said, you came across some people making claims that seemed to be kind of, you know, a little extraordinary. Maybe, you know, maybe they're a little bit high, and they're, you know, they're not exactly have their skeptical caps on. And then after a while, looking at the data, you've really come to this view of cannabis as being really an extra special quiver or arrow in our quiver of medicines. So, you know, talk about that. Like, how did you start to really shift into, you know, what is it about cannabis that makes it more special than just that it can ameliorate this or that, or, you know, increase hunger when you're, you know, for people who are having difficulty putting weight on and things like that. But you see a much more robust range of healing potentials in there.
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked, because that is my great white whale. That is the whole secret of why I'm writing this book. And it explains why cannabis is so basic to not only human life, but any life that has a spinal column has its own endogenous cannabinoid system. Just like the extracting the morphine molecule out of the opium plant helped us to discover our endorphin system, which now we can manipulate to relieve so much pain and so many different types of pain. The finding THC in the cannabis plant in 1964 helped us to find anandamide in the human brain, in a pig brain actually, in 1992. And anandamide is the first neurotransmitter we found that is a cannabinoid produced in our own brains. And so it's latching onto the first receptor we found, CB1, just like THC does. And so if your endorphin molecules are your molecule for pain, and you could say your dopamine molecules are your molecules of addiction, or it's serotonin for happiness, the best way to describe the anandamide system, the anandamide molecule, is as a neurotransmitter of balance. And the endocannabinoid system, in its huge totality across the body and brain, as the homeostasis system for your body. And that really gets the heart of why and how cannabis can be such a good medicine for such a wide swath of diseases. Wherever the body's out of balance in all of these different ways, the endocannabinoid system or weed can come in and just calm things down. And that's so often what we need in this life within ourselves.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, even on the level of like popular knowledge, I think most of us, you know, we all know about serotonin with, you know, SSRIs. We sort of have this sort of pop association with happiness and mood. You know, everybody knows about dopamine now, and everybody knows like, oh, the dopamine squirt you get when you get an email or a text. And that's like a widely, you know, distributed pop meme. And there's problems with those pop memes, but they also help, you know, kind of acclimatize all of us to the fact that we are also nervous systems that are working in these biochemical ways, and that we have to become familiar and intimate with that, you know, keeping our minds aware of the mythologizing possibilities. But I don't think that that's happened really yet with the endocannabinoid system. I think that in a way it's still kind of not suppressed, but it's there's a vagueness around recognizing the systemic nature of the system within us, leaving aside THC just for the moment, just in terms of what our own natural production is, as well as these associations that you're talking about with balance. Is that just a weird artifact of how things get popular, or do you see there's a way in which we're still kind of blocked about recognizing how intimate this system is to us?
Well, I think mostly what we need is a prophet. Because it took Jack Hare preaching about hemp to really get the idea out there that this really old plant was useful, industrial, in all kinds of ways. And he would set up his little shop right in front of the Capitol building in D.C., take a whole bunch of acid, and just spend all day preaching about how and why hemp works. And he spread the word, and it finally took off, even though it's not the sexiest topic as far as things go. It's great for fiber. It's great for making concrete. And in the same way, people don't get that excited about neurochemistry, which always befuddles me because, you know, I think this stuff's fascinating. But people often tell me, oh, I love hearing about the science, but you know, you get a paragraph explanation in and you can already see the eye glaze starting. It's just not what gets people as motivated as much. But once they start to see about the potential healings that are very easy to get with something like non-psychoactive CBD oil you can buy online, that's going to really help spreading the word more than anything else. Stories is what convinces people, which is why my book, I'm having a fun, sexy metaphor explaining neurochemistry with fish under the sea, hence anandamide being my great white whale. But what's really going to change hearts and minds is all of the grandparents I have from around the country turning to the camera, turning to the page in this graphic novel and saying, this is how and why it worked for me. And here were the challenges, because, you know, it's not easy for an elderly person to incorporate a plant medicine into their life of any kind. It's not really the American way to modulate your use, pay attention to what works for you, You know, the doctors always hear, you know, I want to be healthy, but I don't want to have to do anything for it. And knowing yourself with using any plant medicine, especially marijuana, is tricky, and it takes knowing thyself.
Yeah, no, that is a whole aspect of drug culture, even underground drug culture, that's positive, that nobody really talks about, is that leaving aside all the problems and issues, that when you're involved in it consciously, one of the things you're developing is this kind of reliance on your own experience. Yes, on the experience of others and the reports on others, but you recognize there's differences and distinctions, and that at some level you kind of have to trust and test your own body and start to really kind of perform experiments on yourself. And that idea of performing experiments on yourself and being comfortable with it, you know, I think is an extremely positive way just in general to live your life. But it's also particularly helpful given all the decisions and odd opportunities that lie ahead, not just with psychopharmacology, but with, you know, implants and new technologies and, you know, ways of communicating. I mean, there's going to be so much bizarre mutant stuff is already, you know, in our faces, let alone what's coming down the pike. And you have to be able to sort of develop that facility and that willingness to kind of experiment with your own experience and your own body and your own mind. And that is, I think, a big break for a lot of people, and they do associate that with something still a little unseemly. Do you think it makes a difference that CBD is in on its own, you know, pharmacologically, you know, or psychologically kind of not much of an issue? Is that going to help this, or is there still like the kind of taint of cannabis even around CBD?
There can be a taint of cannabis around CBD, but it's becoming less and less, I'd say, because when I talk to a lot of people about how they can convince their grandparents, and when they learn that, A, this is not going to get you high, the biggest risk is it might wake you up, like a cup of tea might wake you up, so the best thing is to try it in the morning. And when they hear that it can be ordered online and shipped to your house, actually, I just so people know, I always recommend Bluebird Botanicals out of Colorado. They make good, clean medicine, and they'll ship it anywhere. If you're here in New York, you can go to Alchemist Kitchen as well. But it's just good to get good quality stuff, because there's also some stuff out there made by hemp oil hustlers. But when you can tell somebody that it's not going to get you high and it can come directly to your house over the internet, it helps a lot. And then it usually comes down to the stories. Sometimes people want me to send them all the data I have from all the mouse experiments and human trials and things like that. But that usually isn't what's going to change people's minds. It's looking up your specific disease on the forums and the word CBD. And then you'll find dozens of other patients, and they'll have tricks of the trade of what worked for them and what combos and what timings. And none of them might be quite your answer, but you'll see what the range of potential answers is. And it's comforting to know that this is working for other people. And for you, it is. There's very few reasons not to try it.
Yeah, this is great news. I mean, I've thought about this issue myself with my folks, and you know, they haven't really encountered some of the really heavy problems of the end of life issues, but it's just around the corner. And I've thought about this issue too, about how do I bring it up and not seem like, oh yeah, it's our druggy son, you know, pushing his weirdness again. And you know, and just the whole approach of using stories and just the wide range of information that's out there. But what are the kinds of issues and health concerns that particularly older people have that they really should be thinking about this, like first and foremost, like the way you're talking about Parkinson's disease, other neurodegenerative diseases, presumably that includes some of the early onset of senility and Alzheimer's as well. But what are some of the other things that are really like high on the list of like, look, if this is what your issue is, let's give this a shot, Grandma.
Well, I'll start with the two obvious negatives, and then hint at a whole bunch of the good positives. The thing to watch out for with medical weed in general is it can be a slight strain on the heart, especially if you're smoking stuff with THC in it. But even CBD, looks like, is worth considering keeping at a lower dose because of the heart effects, depending on the person. It's not that big a risk as far as things go, but it's worth mentioning. The other one, which I almost have never heard mentioned anywhere and really needs to be, is that CBD has been shown to lower the activation of the CYP450 enzymes that are in the liver. And these are really important because they're responsible for processing something like 75% of the drugs that come into our body, often activating them or turning them into some kind of form we can use. And so basically, those drugs where your doctor says you can't, you should be careful drinking lots of grapefruit juice with this drug, that's the same mode of action that it's doing. And so if you have one of those kind of medications, that's the only drug interaction risk worth mentioning, is that CBD can kind of do that same thing. Again, I think at the levels most people are going to be using CBD, it isn't that big a risk, but it's worth paying attention to for medication interaction. But for the most part, what it seems to do is either help people kick whatever kind of pharmaceuticals they're on, or to use a lot less of them, especially around pain. One of the most important parts is that CBD and small amounts of THC help opioids work better. So you need less for after surgery. You need less even if you have an opiate habit. This will help make a little bit seem like more. But for the elderly specifically, the most important thing, what I would urge anybody to give a try for, is diseases around neurodegeneration. Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, MS, ALS, all of these, it is foolhardy, really, not to give CBD a try, because it is so protective for the brain that it shouldn't be skipped. It also works very well for so many of the autoimmune disorders like arthritis, lupus, fibro, and MS, because MS is both a neurodegenerative disease and a autoimmune disease where the brain's own myelin sheaths are getting attacked. And so it works so well for the autoimmune disorders that some scientists are suggesting that it might be an endocannabinoid deficiency underlying these autoimmune disorders that so often radiate out of the gut, which I suspect, there's not really much data on this, but I suspect part of the reason that the cannabinoids are so healing is that they help our gut bacteria somehow. The more and more this decade especially, we've been learning the importance of our microbiome. But at this point, we know so little about how it actually works. We're just starting to tag the entities that are even down there. We don't know how the ecosystem functions. But cannabis helps so much for those kind of things. I wouldn't be surprised in 20 or 30 years we realize that's part of what makes CBD and THC work so well.
So we've been talking about CBD and in the sort of, certainly in the kind of popular presentation of cannabis as a medicine, there's often this distinction made, you know, CBD is really, you know, the main medicine we're talking about, and now the industry is like producing CBD without THC content so that people can take it and not have these kind of have psychoactive effects and target the medicine. Do you think that in that process there's the possibility of losing a little sense of what THC and the other more psychoactive cannabinoids in a weed can do as well? That there's also healing properties to things beyond CBD?
Yes, I do think it's a real risk that people just switch to stuff that isn't going to alter their mind. Which in one sense is too bad, but in the medical sense, for someone perhaps already dealing with a lot, is for the best. And it's the pharmaceuticalization of cannabis is a really fascinating and thorny question. I mean, as you can imagine, all the stoners just hate the idea completely that these companies will get their fingers into it. But on the flip side, when you're dealing with really serious conditions, end-of-life stuff, and rare disorders, that's not the time to be smoking some ganja or just doing haphazardly whatever CBDs you feel like. That's a time that it's worthwhile to have good double-blind studies to realize which dosing mechanisms work the best. When you're actually looking at the markers of what counts as healthy here, what are the combinations that are going to do well? And the problem with the pharmaceutical approach is they are usually tend to be single molecule type of thinkers, because that's what's reproducible. You want as little variables as possible, which is also why women are very much underrepresented in how drugs work on people, because of their hormone cycles, the menstruation cycles that are going to change the data. And that's the last thing a pharmaceutical company would want. And so for a plant like cannabis with 80 cannabinoids in it, a whole bunch of terpenes, a whole bunch of flavonoids, what they call the effect is the entourage effect, because all of the pieces, all the molecules are working together and making such a different effect from each different strain on each person's different endocannabinoid system. But what the entourage effect really means is this hand waving, being like, we don't really know. We know some of what happens. We know some of how the mechanisms of how it happens, but it's just too complicated for this kind of reductionist study of single markers. It's really more of a thing where the best data you're going to get is from some old pot doctor in the north of California who's been seeing the same patients for 50 years, and she knows how to round off the how it usually goes, the crazy little exceptions, and that one time in a thousand reaction that sometimes happens.
Yeah, it's going to be so interesting because, you know, of course, intrepid, weed chemist entrepreneurs are, you know, already breaking down all of these cannabinoids and the terpenes and figuring out ways to, you know, to recombine them. And then people will be coming up with their special mixes, and some of them will be for psychoactive properties, and some of them they'll be increasing health claims made about certain ones. And then, of course, each of those are meeting individual nervous systems, which have their own responses, just as we know that, you know, the same strain can have a very different response with you and your friends. You know, you have different reactions to it. So it's so complex. I mean, the complexity space of cannabis is so extraordinary. And we're going to be right now, it's already happening, and much more so in the next 5 years, 5, 10 years of people really going into that complex assemblage and extracting different relationships and different balances and making claims for them in different ways, some of which will be dubious and some of which will be based on hard studies, some of which will be based on reports. And it's going to be just such a carnival.
Yeah, that's a good word for it. It's going to be fascinating to watch. There's going to be so much good out of this for health stuff, but on the flip side, watching the business stuff evolve, I mean, sometimes it's people really believe in it, and sometimes it's just, you know, annoying suits that are exactly the stereotype you see as the shark coming in to take the jobs away from the old Vietnam vet who was going to grow for his friends the rest of his life, and the grandma medible maker who won't be able to have a qualified kitchen to legally sell in that state. And I think it really speaks to what my biggest fear is, which is how the federal government is going to finally regulate that once they do. Because each of these states is a different experiment, and you can see how things pan out somewhat in that microcosm. And Colorado is a great example of trying to keep the medicine cheap, trying to tax the tourists who come into town and clip them for money for the schools, which seems like it's working out pretty well. But then there's Washington State, and I fear that's how the federal government can go, because really how that worked out is the medical dispensary system there kind of got destroyed by legalization. And on the western side of the state, in cities like Seattle, it's a whole bunch of white guys making money off the plant and paying in the large amounts it takes to get the license out, while on the eastern side of the state, the kids of color are getting busted at the exact same rates they always have been. And there are some really angry lawyers I've talked to in Washington where they just see such a crooked system that is now only giving money to people who never put the time in to legalize this plant, while continuing all of the racist horrors that really kicked up this war on drugs once the around the turn of the last century.
Well, it's a fascinating example. I didn't know that particular issue. I had known some of the problems with the Washington State model, but I had not recognized the way in which this form of commercialization and legalization is still intimately tied to the old regime of social control, particularly of black and brown people through punitive laws. Which then, you know, kind of raises this other question. You know, we've mostly been talking about medical marijuana here. We've been talking about the effects of CBD. What's going to happen as the market, you know, explores it and pharmaceutical companies come in? But at the same time, this is happening in a space where this legacy of criminality, of social control, of, you know, devastating prison sentences, of population management, essentially, is also, you know, equally powerful and still part of our, if not more powerful, and still part of the American reality. So it's a strange, like, you got biochemistry over here, and you got you know, hardcore realpolitik on the other side. How are you bringing those things together with your work? Like, particularly, you know, we haven't talked much about your book, and I know you're going to be doing a lot of, you know, work on the science side and the healing side. But you're also really looking at politics, American history, American racism, structural racism. Talk a little bit about how you weave these two things kind of together, or how the narrative form of the whale of Moby Dick helps you, you know, manage these different aspects of such a complex story.
The thing that was perfect about Moby Dick for me was it gave me the exact structure I needed to talk about the highs and lows of what this crazy country is. And I also think it's probably the best thing ever written by an American. And it presages everything about the imperialism that this country is going to spread around the world. And by the way, lots of people always apologize to me that they haven't read Moby Dick. You don't need to read it. There's an audiobook version by this guy, Frank Mueller, who was a Shakespearean actor and the best voice guy of his generation. It's just so perfect. I get a little flustered reading it, but it's the best way. You can listen to the entire whale in 22 hours and get down, I think, the best thing ever created here. Because half of it is about this whale, this beautiful piece of nature that in every direction you look, it just is stupefying. And that is cannabis as a medicine. It's almost too big to be believed. And it's going to take me half of a 135 chapter book to really lay out all the proofs we have from the ancient pharmacopoeias, from the modern mouse data, and then all the stories from the old ladies. But the other half of Moby Dick is about Ahab. It is the dark side of America. And the second layer of the book is about this America's first great industry of using predominantly people of color as the workers to go out and turn these pieces of nature into blood and money, all funded by the good, pious Quakers back in Nantucket. And so it shows a lot of what America's going to do with its industry, but especially what it does with the war on drugs and the blatantly racist start to it that only later on globbed in the moneyed powers that came to it later. And so it really gives the structure of the repeated story every generation of how America has been dealing with drugs as a tool to keep those people down.
Well, one question you can ask about Moby Dick, which is also a question that I'd ask about you and your project regarding cannabis, is how much of this war is still a religious war? How much are we still playing out, whether we know it or not, old scripts that are based on sacred views of the world, whether they're dark or light, whether they embrace the whale or they're terrified of it? And does that, or does that get kind of some, ultimately get in the way maybe of a more rational and secular way of looking at these political and medical problems?
It's a great question. And I'd say it's hard to know the motivations, especially from the religious side now. Because I think the church will catch up on this one. They're often slow to, but it's just so obviously good for healing that it might change people's minds. And just perhaps, though it doesn't have to at all, because Jesus's very first miracle was turning water into wine. And that somehow gets forgotten in the church where I grew up, where you're not allowed to drink at all, even though the first thing our Savior did was get us wasted. And that just because the logic isn't there doesn't mean that we will change. And I think the hard part, I think, is around this plant, I think there's less conspiracy theories than a lot of stoners want to believe about how much business is blocking this, how much pharma is blocking it. They're certainly no friend, and they're funding some initiatives and all that. I don't think it's as darkly clawed as people like it to believe. I always hear people say, oh, the war on drugs just doesn't make any sense. It does make sense. It is. If you want to stay in control of a population, it's one of the most powerful and obvious tools that you could ever use. Just like Ehrlichman is now known to have said, we knew that heroin and grass were the drugs of our enemies, the hippies and the blacks, and so we just associated them and then could beat the hell out of them every night on the nightly news using those clubs. And I suspect that that still is one of the primary motivations for keeping the war on drugs going, is the habit of having this powerful tool, and then the cowardice of politicians. I don't think there's so much directly under the thumb of these various interests as much as they are, you know, loath to change. They generally tend to be dinosaurs, and no one wants to take a risk. And even with half the states having some kind of liberalized cannabis law, and over half the country now in favor of legalization, politicians still can't say it out loud, which I think speaks more to their courage or lack of it than anything else.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The portion of the book that you've released, Chapter 37, Sunset, is a chunk from this wonderful mad work. And I say that in the best sense. I think it's because I've seen your workroom. You know, you work in this room filled with books and note cards all over the walls, and you have your computer set up with all of these audio files recorded. And it's just this, like, I can just see all of this research and all of the multidimensional webs that are woven by deep, deep research. And I can just feel the presence of this whale, you know, that's emerging between all your work. But I'm glad we got to see a little chunk of it. In June, you released this Chapter 37, Sunset. You know, talk about that and what that meant to put it out at that time.
I felt really blessed, in fact, that I just happened to release this chapter in the middle of Pride Month, because it's about how Reagan ignoring the AIDS crisis really helped to ignite the medical marijuana movement, because at that point in history, a lot of Americans knew that weed wasn't the reefer madness, crazy drug of death that had been preached. The hippies had come out and proven differently. But there wasn't a national sense in any way that this was a medicine, despite a huge amount of history that I'm still figuring out that says otherwise. But because cannabis, marijuana from the triangle up north, the Emerald Triangle, worked so well for all of the symptoms of AIDS, as well as all of the side effects from the really harsh early medications that were being used, like AZT. And it worked so well that even the lazy journalists of the press could find an easy story if they went to San Francisco and spread the word. And you had fierce heroes like Brownie Mary making, at one point, 15,000 pot brownies per month and give them out to the sickest possible people she could find in San Francisco. She called all of them her kids. She kept getting arrested. She kept swearing at judges and cops who arrested her, and just so beautifully showed how this plant got out there. It was a ton of work. It was a ton of people getting arrested. It was a concerted effort by jackboots to keep this down during the height of Reagan's harsh presidency. And I really frame it around Angels in America, which is one of the best things in American theater, I think, a gay fantasia on national themes. And so it actually is kind of funny, because by the end of it, of this 60-page sample chapter, only about 10 pages were actually about pot, and then about 50 pages were a fight for queer rights in America. But I decided that must be okay, because Moby Dick isn't that much about a whale, in fact. It's about everything else. And so being able to put out this howl of tribute to the queer heroes who fought for recognition during this really harsh, closeted time, I'm glad I got to do that soon after the tragedy at Pulse in Orlando.
Yeah, yeah. And then what was the decision about to do it as a graphic novel? I mean, it's laid out. You use a lot of photographs. You use you know, kind of squares of text in different fonts. You're kind of playing with the layout of text and image and historical archive. It's all sort of resonating. Do you feel like it communicates better? Does it help your writing? Does it help sharpen the ideas?
now that I'm deep into it, I realize how much it does sharpen me. It makes it easier to make different layers and to have little asides and to hint at things using the graphics of my wise-eyed illustrator, Wyra, who's staying here with me. And really, she helps so much in bringing the, I call her my Queequeg, my Sophia, that Christ-like figure who just can see how things should be put together. And I'm more of, I'm the wordsmith and putting together the data. But I initially started with the graphic novel idea mostly because I knew that the best selling point would be actually looking at the people being interviewed, whether they be famous old stoners or unknown young kids with epilepsy in their chests that could only be healed by cannabis, or most especially grandparents all over the country. And that was what got me started on the graphic novel path. And then I just started to realize how many more possibilities that opened up and ways of storytelling. And so for the next sample chapter, I'm talking about how we found THC, how we figured out its structure, how we figured out how to make synthesized versions of it. And for that one, I realized that THC in this metaphor should be an elephant. And so really, this gives me a vehicle to smoke a good bit of hash for a couple nights straight and learn everything I can about elephants and then see how perfectly that they line up to the history of hemp across the world. They both have been such influential symbols that of both imperialism and holiness, and that's the hemp plant throughout world history. So yeah. It gives me a nice place to throw together a bunch of different ideas.
Yeah, and I think that it's precisely by building those networks between different disciplines, between different sources, different ways of thinking politically, thinking biochemically, thinking historically, thinking imaginatively, thinking in terms of sacred myths and images and stories, that in a way that's the mind that we need to develop really to deal with our future, whether we're talking about our relationship with psychoactives or any number of, you know, these sort of dense networks that we find that we're completely enmeshed within. And, you know, the old rationalist reductive mind frame that you talked about at the beginning, which has been so incredibly productive with science, but it has some real limitations. And one of them is its inability to deal with this kind of multidimensional, you know, approach to the world, which is, I think, ultimately going to lead towards a saner way, at least of engaging psychoactives in our reality on top of all sorts of other tricky others. I mean, we have about 10 minutes left here, but there's a lot of stuff we haven't talked about. I wanted to give you a shot to give a little plug for a symposia and just sort of say what's special about that organization or what the goals are with that in terms of this larger psychedelic renaissance.
Cool. Yeah, Symposia has really been a great labor of love and to see it emerge. We started off doing conferences about drugs a couple years ago at Amherst and started moving them around. And then we also started doing lecture nights on various cities up and down the East Coast, pretty much from Boston to D.C. And those are really great for bringing people together. And I realized that the heart of what I wanted to help facilitate was just creating community and forming networks within this often disparate drug world. And for me, as we got down to our smallest type events, storytelling events, often open mic storytelling events with nobody scheduled, I realized that's really where the magic is. More so than even listening to a lecturer on stage with someone getting up there, especially someone who's scared to tell a very dark, hard trip. This is how we learn from each other. And it's also a great place for us to mix the generations. And one thing, when I am picking speakers for our various events, I like to try to get them from the four different threads of the drug world that I know somewhat well. Of course, the cannabis stuff, but also harm reduction and needle exchange, and then the world of psychedelic medicine, and then the world of people fighting on the ground against the war on drugs, like the officers from law enforcement against prohibition. By the way, if you're doing events anywhere in the country, always go to LEAP and ask them for a speaker. They'll show up with someone who has a speech of any length you need and is always right on point. And everyone believes a former cop who says we need to end the drug war, especially because it's a waste of our time. And so I like getting those four different groups into the room because they don't know enough about each other, especially the more white bread psychedelic world, which is quite close to my heart. But the harm reduction world, they don't know enough about each other. there's a lot of like, oh, that's their drugs. And there isn't as much mixing when we're all in this together. And the psychedelic world needs harm reduction as much as the harm reduction world does. And the harm reduction world, to have more ibogaine, acid, and mushrooms there would be a good thing. And that comes from people being in the same room, listening to each other's stories, and giving lots of break time so people can just get to know each other. That's especially why we like working with Students for Sensible Drug Policy. Anywhere in the country, if you're listening, find us. We're happy to work with you because it's just such a network of really excellent kids who have their eye on the prize, get stuff done, and are going to go on usually to create some kind of nonprofit that is their part to help fight this monster.
Yeah, I think this is great. We're coming around to the beginning again in the sense of a different role that storytelling can play. You know, it seems to me that there's something about psychoactive experience that demands storytelling, that absolutely calls for it. The stories have to be front and center. If for no other reason, then ultimately we're going to be narrating our own individual experience in trip reports or whatever you want to call it. But there's a larger level. You talked about the way in which stories help give us information, like actual more than anecdotal data, when you start building it together, that help people navigate their own health issues regarding cannabis, and that part of that begins with people telling stories. And now you're talking about the way in which the storytelling, you know, opens up a kind of place of intimacy that allows people, you know, with different orientations and different goals, different agendas, to resonate better than just hearing another talk of you know, someone telling why their approach is important or how it's worked or, you know, the kind of more standard things you see, let's say, in a conference setting. But there's something really special that happens when people share their intimate stories, even on a political or larger kind of ideological level.
And that's why Symposia is always interested in working with any group in the country who's doing this kind of work and to just be the chance to come in and organize a storytelling session. I am always trying to feature our elders and have more female voices on stage, more people of color. If you have any recommendations, we just want these events to happen. This is what changes the world in these small ways. And the more voices that we can get out there, I think the more normalized this stuff is going to be. And to have events like this and people like Michael Pollan writing books on psychedelics, that is what is going to really help eventually normalize this stuff. And actually, a quote that's worth mentioning, I can never remember where I found it, but Gary Snyder said that it's going to take three generations to integrate these powerful medicines, drugs, state changers into our society because we just aren't used to them and they have such strength. And the first generation is going to be the over-exuberance, and that was the 60s, and dad took away the car keys. And then it needs to be that cautious second generation, which was now the psychedelic renaissance and the slower pace of lab research. But I hope that the third generation will be this syncretism of the rationalist mindset of learning a lot more about how these drugs actually work dosage-wise, neurochemically, and combining that with the wisdom from the people groups all over the world who have been doing this for so long, that feminine ritual-making quality, and taking the best of both of those worlds and forging something new that can harness this power in a useful way for healing, for a slightly better world.
Yeah, that's very, very well said, and it's something that I really sense with a lot of the you know, more engaged, dynamic young people who are you know, doing this work. For me, the action really is in those that multidimensional quality, that ability to move through different worlds and to really draw the best from a more scientific or even more skeptical approach, but remaining open to the transformative power of storytelling and of visionary experience. And it's you know, it's really heartening. You know, it does probably what jazzed me about meeting you guys in Symposia and, you know, a lot of other young people who are doing this kind of work, younger than me at least. And you know, and then you're bringing that into that book too, which I just can't wait to see that thing. It's beautiful. We only have about a couple of minutes left here, but even though it's too short a time, there was one thing we were going to talk about that was going to blow our minds. It's a totally different topic in a way, but I still want a little nibble. You were talking about one of the future drugs issues that we're going to see is the manufacture of opioids through yeast, and how this is really going to change a whole zone, another psychoactive zone that we haven't talked much about.
Oh man, it's
thumbnail.
I always say we are in the brave new world of acquisition. It is the best time to want drugs between the dark net and how it's being made and moved. And so now, just last year in Nature, someone figured out how to put genes into a yeast and then have it just pump out an opiate drug. And it's not that hard to do. This stuff could be done by regular chemists, and it won't be long until the mafias around the world and the underground drug producers realize they don't need to depend on Afghani opium, probably being run by the CIA just like they ran it out of Vietnam. And instead, it will be democratized. And opiums are only the first ones. It's going to be all of these different drugs that are going to be being made by microorganisms very soon, or printed on synthetic biology machines. Oh, I know less about that, but it's going to open it up to so many people, and it's also going to open up a next phase of the war on drugs, which is there will be strands of genetic code that will be illegal to possess, which is a fascinating concept because they can be used to make things that you are not supposed to have.
Yeah, it's the same kind of issue when we think about, you know, 3D printers and guns and home bio labs and developing biological weapons. And there's just this extraordinary term we're just starting to turn around with, whether you want to call it the democratization or the just sort of, you know, massive distribution of manufacturing in the full sense of the word. And that's going to be, another crazy ride. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Lex Pelger, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you so much, Eric. It's been great.
Great. And you can find out more about Lex on his website, LexPelger, LexPelger.com. He's got a lot of his writings up there, so check that out, and also think about Symposia. I'm going to take the rest of August off, much-needed vacation, and so I'll see you in December. No, September, excuse me. That was probably a wish fulfillment of a truly long vacation. But I'll get back on the horse soon, guys. And until then, keep your minds open.